The following broadcast of Sioux Valley Voice was recorded earlier. You will not be able to call in during the next hour. You can listen to past episodes of Sioux Valley Voice online anytime at ktna.org.
And good morning. Welcome to Sioux Valley Voice, KTNA's live call-in program. I'm Will Peterson in the KTNA studio, and with me is Dog Musher, Jeff King. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, Will.
How are you?
I'm good.
Good. I'm glad to see you.
I thought you retired.
Yeah, I did.
I said I retired once, too.
we're going to talk about that here in a minute. Let me get back to this here for a second. Sioux Valley Voice is a call-in program, and I encourage all of you listeners to call in, take part, and ask Jeff your questions. I've got plenty to talk about, and I've got plenty of questions, but the program provides you with the opportunity to directly speak with our guest, and I encourage you to take the opportunity. The number to call is 733-1200. Thanks for being here, Jeff, first off.
My pleasure. I'm worked it into a trip to town, and it's going to be a good way to start the day.
Here we are, 11th day of January, busy time of the year for you guys. Crazy time, right?
Pretty busy, yeah. Oh. I was running dogs till 7 o'clock or so last night, made a trip up the Yannert River, getting ready for next week's Cusco.
Hey, okay, Copper Basin race this weekend.
Yeah?
You have no teams in that?
I do not have a team, but we'll be watching closely, a lot of friends, and always fun to watch races.
You pay attention to all the races, huh?
I do.
Yeah, yeah. Copper Basin, what year was it that you won that race? 97?
I'm pretty sure I've won it a couple times, but I don't remember. My last one was not that long ago, maybe 2010 in there, I think.
Did you win?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, yeah.
You've won a bunch?
Alan Moore was second, yep.
Oh, one of the few times he was second.
Yeah.
Jeff, tell me about the first time you ran the Iditarod. We're going to talk about a lot of things here. Probably we need a few hours, but your first Iditarod, 1981.
Well, I first remember hearing about the Iditarod when I was in a wall tent out in what is now Denali National Park. I was trapping on the north side of the park and had an AM radio, and I was listening to Joe May finish the race over a AM radio in my wall tent, and went, wow, that just sounds so cool. I want to do that. And I had a friend, Gary Whittemore from Cantwell. He had a small dog team, and he lived in a bus with his family, the classic Denali, Alaska homesteader. And we both trained together, and I remember him and I talking and saying, I want to do the Iditarod. And I remember us agreeing, well, I'll go if you go. And he said, yeah, I'll go if you go. And it just seemed too overwhelming to do alone. And so we teamed up as training partners and confidants and started training. In fact, I was just telling my girlfriend, Kristen, the other day how I remembered going out the Yannert Valley where I was just last night. And running into somebody, and I told them, I need to make a 40-mile run tonight. And I remember 40-mile run was like an incredibly
long trip.
and now, you know, we do 65 days a week. And how different it's changed, how much has changed in preparation, our understanding of the dogs, and what they're capable of. So anyway, Gary and I both went. We both bought dog from Dick Mackey and Rick Mackey and Susan. Eventually I got dog from Susan Butcher and Swenson and but I had 13 dogs.
You started with 13.
I own 14, and I started with 13. And one of them was a stray from Cantwell that had got bitten in the ear as a puppy and had a hole in his ear. And so I tied a piece of orange yarn through it. And that orange yarn stayed with him his whole life. And his name was Gandhi. He was my lead dog and had been a stray in Cantwell. And very, very, very good times.
You finished, if I'm going to get this right, somewhere around 15 days.
Yep, 15 days. At the time, it would have won every race but one or two. But I was 28.
You were 28, and,
I think it was Swenson did a...
81, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. An 11-day race, I think it was.
Mm-hmm. And then you didn't come back to the Iditarod till 91. 10-year break there from Iditarod. What was that about?
Well, first of all, I was broke.
you were a dog musher.
Yeah. Well, I was figuring out how broke a guy is trying to put a dog team together. The Yukon Quest came to birth. And mm-hmm. I remember wanting to be the best at something. And I remember distinctly realizing that if I could get in on the ground floor of a race on its first year, that would turn out to be the big one, I would have an advantage. And I thought I would always be playing catch up with the guys who started the Iditarod and were running it since 74, mm-hmm. you know, Riley and Swenson and Susan and Sonny. And I go, I'm behind the eight ball on experience. And, I want to try a different race. It was also closer to home. Also was easier to pay for. And so I did that in hopes of being able to excel there. And it was some degree, I suppose, I did hang in there. And I think my first year I was fifth, then I was fourth, then I was third. And... then I won the Quest, and then I finished my last year. I went the year Vern Halter won, and I finished second, so I decided I had to go back and get second because I hadn't done that. And but a lot of memories there, boy. I can have visions of 15 dog teams nose to tail down the Yukon River, breaking trail in cold weather, and the things compared to today, just kind of mind-boggling.
Well, you kind of got near to my next question, the evolution. You talked about evolution of what you learned since your first Iditarod. How has the sport evolved?
Well, look at about the same rate cell phones has evolved mm-hmm. in the same time. Pretty darn dramatic. I mean, my first Iditarod, I changed plastic, bolt-on plastic in Nikolai. And I had shipped it out, but it was pre-drilled. And I thought I was just at the cutting edge, you mm-hmm. know, with bolt-on quarter-inch plastic and countersink bolts. And so, you know, I remember the first time Rick Mackey had a little snow machine drag pad between his runners, and what the hell is that for? He wants to slow down. Joe May showed me this, and it works great. I'm just going, who'd have thought of that, man? And, you know, the first time there was a drag mat, and Tim White's first sled, I remember Gary saying, the stanchions are made of rope. And I go, that's impossible. You can't make a stanchion out of rope. And I remember I wanted to see this sled that had rope stanchions. And, you know, of course, it was Tim White's first Tim White toboggan that pretty simple, had a kerf down the middle and bent runners and piece of angle aluminum on it, and away you went. So headlamps, I mean, I can remember building headlamps and bulbs and batteries and battery packs and suitcase batteries and a battery pack I wore on my back, that was going to be the cat's meow.
That first year you ran, were you using Coleman stove still?
Yeah.
Rattling down the trail for 1,000 miles.
And I had a square aluminum pot that I thought was just the coolest thing since sliced bread. But it probably weighed 7 or 8 pounds at least. And I got it from the hotel at Denali, where after throwing out kitchen equipment. But it had the surface area, several square feet of surface area. And I don't know who it was, probably Swenson or Sonny, that designed a two-burner Coleman that each had its own tank.
Mm.
So we modified the Coleman so that the second burner was just as ferocious as the first burner, and you could have double the fuel. But I remember becoming halfway comfortable with pouring white gas on the whole thing and lighting it off before we would get it, just to get it warm enough.
Just to warm it up, yeah.
Just to warm it
up. Some guys used that paste stuff to warm up that Coleman generator.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, yeah, I can remember. And I can remember falling asleep in Nikolai that first year trying to heat my dog food, and the surface area of my pot was losing heat faster than it was coming in through the bottom, and kind of warming the bottom and a layer of ice in the top of the pot when I woke up from kind of dozing off, and the whole thing was pretty pretty primitive by comparison. But, you know, I was just thinking that, well, we weren't building a campfire. Instead, we had this modern stove,
mm-hmm.
and it's a wonder we didn't blow up.
You know, I don't know if you remember this, Jeff, or if you ever heard of this, Terry Atkins. He came to the start of a race one time with a dog sled that was made out of steel tubes.
Welded together.
And he had a generator in the front of his sled. And he was using one of the tubes as a exhaust, so the exhaust went out the back right near your feet. But I think it was like at Squintna the first day he went to start his thought was, I'm going to be able to cook food while I'm moving. So I get to a place and I'm going to have hot food for the dogs right away, and I'm light years out of this. The pull start rope on his generator broke, I think, in Squintna. It was like 35 below or something. But Terry was one of those...
unique?
Yeah. Well, all dog mushers are unique, Jeff. But he was an early innovator. But that's one of the things that you've come to be in this sport, an innovator. I'm not sure if it's just a matter of how to get that little edge from one year to the next on your competition, but it seems that you continue to change the sport in some ways.
Well, I love to take credit for being an innovator, but we're on the back of a sled being pulled by dogs. It's pretty primitive. And we live in a world that put a man on the moon and has cell phones and night vision goggles. So we had a lot of stuff to try.
Mm-hmm.
This very primitive form of transportation, you know, what the difference we could make in our comfort or the comfort of the dogs and the equipment that, I mean, and I have taken no end to the satisfaction I get from trying to come up with a new idea. And, I got one this year, every year. It's like, oh my God, why didn't we ever think of this?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember the first time I brought my, quote, sit-down sled to us, and people laughed at me.
Mm-hmm.
The first time I used a half harness, they laughed at me. What is it? You gone nuts, you
no
know? And now
lines.
It's common procedure. And it's like, well, why didn't we think of that, you know? Mm-hmm. And yes, I'll take credit for being the innovator, but all you need to do is step back and take other parts of our society and the things we have available, hardware, nutrition, and play with it, you know. So it's been really fun. I have a couple of handlers from years back that love to tease me about, at one point we were building sleds and I was using something to make something else out of, a bracket that was designed for the fence, but I was going to put it on the sled. And the guy's going, well, how'd you think of that? And I remember they always tease me because I said, don't look at what it is. Look at what it can be. And I think that's the way I approach this. And, you know, they've not all worked by any means, but they all have some potential logic. You know, there was one year I tried to make a, I had Motorola as a sponsor and I wanted to run little speakers up my tow line so the dogs could hear music. I mean, really? Pavlov and dairy farmers know for a fact that domestic animals do different things with audio stimulation. What if I could get the dogs, if they could know that it was feeding time or speed up time or sleep time, all with audio? It's a no-brainer if we ever figure out how to do it. The dogs have tremendous ability to take in audible signals. And, you know, generally we're too tired to sing for long and give the right information available to them. But and lights on the dogs, I think we still haven't fully capitalized on the world of LED lighting and for safety reasons for mushers and dogs. And here I am all lit up. I still get hit by a snow machine, but I think in general you're safer if you know it's something people do with their pets. I don't know why the heck we wouldn't do it with our dogs on the trail. So I love thinking of new ideas.
Okay. Let me switch gears on you, Jeff. Said the copper basins this week, K300 the following week out in Bethel. Looks like conditions are going to be good. Although it's a week away and Bethel changes all the time.
You know, I've seen them better and I've certainly seen them worse. And I know from experience that whatever the trail conditions are 10 days before the race are rarely the way they are during the race. Mm-hmm. But they've had a colder winter, and so it sounds like things are froze up pretty hard. I think it sounds like it would take warm weather, which certainly could happen, but is not the forecast. I've been out there when it's 40 below too, and it's looking like more likely to be cold than warm. But I follow the pictures. I have some friends out there. I've made so many good friends out there. And it is really special. I'm at a point in my life where I'm more interested in talking to Nathan Underwood about fishing than I am about running dogs, you know. And he invited me out to go fishing next July, just the other day. And it's really, really special to have made some good friends in light of the competitive nature I might have exhibited over the years. But
you've won that race 9 times, Jeff.
And I've been really close a few others.
A bunch of times. Okay, you're going out there. I mean, it as usual, I think, what are there, 28, 29 teams in it this year? Big number for that race. A lot of money on the table. That's why there's a lot of mushers out there. And you're going back out there. Can you win this again?
I absolutely could win this again. I know how to build a nice dog team. And it's not like anyone's going to worry, you know, if you think I can't run as fast up the hills as Brent Sass, you're right, but there are no hills.
In the Bethel race, yeah.
And it's a matter of how hard can you push your brake, because we're probably on It looks right now as just frosty ice pretty much the whole way. So, but, you know, just coming down today, driving down here, thinking about this, I was listening to music in my car and listening to Garth Brooks sing about the competition's getting younger and tougher Bronx I've never seen. And, you know, I'm very impressed with Nick Petit's
team.
There's
a bunch of them out there that are coming
Pete's team, mm-hmm. Richie, Yor. I'm kind of the common denominator, the only old school guy left. Myron watches from the sidelines, and Johnny Baker's not coming, and mm-hmm. Swenson hasn't gone. And it's fun to see Ramey Smith back
it
out
is,
there.
It is, yeah.
And Sim, of course.
Let's talk about this race a little bit, Jeff, and I might get this wrong. That for our listeners, K300's 300-mile race. There's a, you have to take 6 hours of, 10 hours of mandatory layover, 6 hours spread out, and then four, some 50
miles. Tulik on the way back.
On the way back, 50 miles from the finish line. It's 300-mile race, but it's essentially a sprint race with 10-hour breaks. You told me a few years ago that you really can't do it with just those 10 hours, that you need another 20 minutes somewhere spread out, maybe in one 20-minute block or two 10-minute breaks or something. How do you get to that point when you know this 10-minute break is going to help my team maintain the speed or catch somebody's in front of me? How's that happen, Jeff?
Well, I think the bottom line is that the first place to take some mandatory rest is 90 miles away. And 90 miles is too far to go without food and water for a dog. And you can't get them to eat and drink without stopping. So that's really the key. And you have to find a place to do it. And two 10-minute stops is like bare minimum. So that's something I just can't get away without.
Well, let's take a quick break here, Jeff, and come back soon. You're listening to Sioux Valley Voice. We'll be back in just a minute or so. Thank you. You're listening to Sioux Valley Voice. I'm Will Peterson, and our guest today is Jeff King, four-time Iditarod champion, nine-time K300 champion. The week after the K300's Tustamina race, how many times have you won that one, Jeff?
More than once. I don't remember.
Yeah. Isn't that great when you can't remember how many times you won a race? There was a stretch there where it was you and Ramey Smith taking turns where this guy could run faster than you, I think, is the deal.
I think I can outrun him now. I don't know.
So the Tustamina race is right after the K300. You're not racing in that, but you have teams in it?
Yeah. My awesome handler, Alex Buteau. I raced his dad and his mom before they were married 40 years ago. But Alex will be running my team, and Kristen Bacon will have a few of my dogs as well. And she and her handler are running it as well. So I'm going to be the handler down there. Really looking forward to it.
You mentioned your competitiveness, Jeff. Are you as competitive as you were?
No.
Are you okay? You used to need to win.
Yeah. I don't need to win.
You don't need to win?
If I win anymore, it'll be with a team that is like a stallion at the horse show. My 2006 win, I could not have been more proud of that team, the speed, the depth, the smiles on their faces. I'm not willing to drive a tired dog team anymore.
But you can win.
Oh, yeah.
You've put yourself in position that didn't work out in the last 5 years.
I think example of, is it 2014 or 13, right outside of safety? That team was beautiful, and I could have won that race if I was willing to make the dogs run into that wind. And they told me they didn't want to. They didn't know there's a paycheck waiting at the end. And, I just don't have – I love it. Most of the time it's really fun. But if it's not really fun for very long – I'm not, for dogs or me, I've been in enough races. I want it to be mostly fun. And, the darn Quest, I wanted to run the Quest a couple years ago. I was looking at a 200-mile leg of 50 below zero and already...
That doesn't sound like fun.
No, it's just nothing about it. It's fun. And
is the Iditarod still fun for you?
Oh, yeah.
Knowing that,
most of the time.
Knowing that, the race starts and the excitement and all that stuff, but then... You guys get into a grind, and there's like minutes of sleep.
Yeah, I don't call it a grind.
You're up on the coast where there's little to no sleep, competition. You're having a good time, Jeff?
Most of the time, yes. As long as my dog team looks good, I'm having fun. And if I can do that and be in the front, I'll be there. And I don't want to, some of the things that most impress me, I will say that, most of the teams I see, including ones in front of me, are really looking nice. Things have changed, and the best dog teams often are some of the most spectacular to watch. Dallas passing me last year, I had a sled full of dogs after being hit by that snow machine, but his team went by me, a very small team, and they were gorgeous. I have a good eye for dogs, and Nick Petit's team is gorgeous. Wade Marr's team is gorgeous. Smooth, tail wagon dog teams. The days of Cowboy Smith grinding it up by being able to stay awake and walk farther, those are gone. Couldn't have been.
I don't think people realize that the first team that gets to Nome looks so beautiful. You wouldn't have known they just went 1,000 miles.
No.
It's amazing.
It is.
And they're probably ready to go another 1,000 on that schedule. Maybe not.
Maybe. I think that if, in fact, that was true, you could have got there even faster. They're ready for a few days off, but by no means spent.
Right,
and we've learned a lot. I think some of the names we just mentioned are very astute, quick-learning guys.
Nick Petit, this is his seventh year running dogs, not racing, running dogs, and he's on a roll. You know, when the Kobuk race, when the Alpine thing, and then the
Kinnick
race. Mm-hmm. Amazing.
Yeah, and, Wade just won a race last weekend, and they're quick learners, and they're really dedicated. And taking good care of the dogs. And,
plus, they're also starting out with great dog teams.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like you having a stray as your lead dog. These guys are coming to you and buying dogs.
Exactly.
And buying the best dogs.
Yeah. I am proud to say they all got dogs from me in those teams.
I think everybody's got dogs from you now, Jeff. So even if you don't come in first, usually some of your dogs do. It's pretty amazing. You still enjoy it as much?
Every bit as much, maybe more so, because the years I don't have the winning effort, I can still have fun because that's not as big a deal anymore. Don't get me wrong, I'll go fast right up until I can't anymore and do it well. But it's really fun, and I enjoy good competition. I really enjoy these guys, and I don't know what I'd do if I didn't race dogs. I would love to mentor some. I have a daughter who for the first time has said, you know, maybe I could you help me run the Iditarod next year, 2018? I went, really? Mm. Yeah, I think I might be able to find time.
Is this the daughter that ran
that.
It before?
No.
Oh.
My youngest.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah.
Cool.
And I'm having dinner with her tonight. I love mentoring. It's so fun to have my girlfriend's also a dog musher and have somebody to, you know. And Alex is, just the other night, Alex, I told him something, or last night, we had a dog with a little bit of soreness in the wrist. He goes, is this from soft trail or hard trail? And I said, you know, I don't think it's either one. I think it's speed. You know, we had the speed a little bit off. And he just said, man, there's just so much to learn. Mm-hmm. Those were the words out of his mouth. And this guy's already run the Iditarod. And he's going, wow, there's so much to learn. Mm-hmm. And I went, wow, how cool is that?
There's
somebody's
so much to
soaking
teach.
It up.
Yeah. You told me, and again, I might get this wrong. Years ago, you told me, I asked you, Do you get off on the Northern Lights? And I think it might have been the time that that comet was hanging around all winter. And you told me a story that you had a handler who sometime after a run or during a run stopped and told you and said something about the Northern Lights. And as I remember the story anyway, you told me that you told him that if you're looking at the Northern Lights and enjoying the scenery, you're looking at the wrong thing. You're not focused. And you wanted him focused on that dog team 24/7. Do you check out the Northern Lights now, Jeff?
Not very often.
Really?
No. I get most of my satisfaction from watching the dogs.
Mm-hmm.
So not to imply that it's a level of seriousness, but it's why I can tell which side of the tow line the dog ought to be on because I'm watching that close or missing him. I still enjoy that. Oh, I looked at the moon last night as I came home. It was really gorgeous. I love, and from, you know, I love taking videos of the dogs now. It's so easy to do, and I get a big kick out of that. But I can't tell you how many times I'm telling my handlers to look at the dang dogs, because they're so mostly during hookup and departure. You know, if they start looking around, that's when, you know, dog pulls the hook or gets on the wrong side of the tow line or a scuffle, you know, they need to be really paying attention. So, I was in a race in Wyoming. I know one year I came in and I was first. It was one of the nights we camped out overnight, one of the legs of the race, and sitting around the campfire, somebody there, Hans Gott, was in the race, and Jesse Royer, and said, geez, did you see those elk? And everyone's going, yeah, that was amazing. There's like 100 of them right along the trail. And I go, what elk? And they all looked at me and goes, you did not see the herd of elk? And I said, were they in the trail? And they said, no. And I go, well, why would have I seen them if they weren't in the trail? I don't know. It served me well, but I've also probably missed some really beautiful sights because of it.
You've probably seen a bunch of them anyway, Jeff. You've been out there a lot.
I tell you, I have one of the most beautiful sights of my life.
Let me interrupt here for a second. 733-1200. We've got another 20 minutes or so. Call in with your question for Jeff King. I'm sure that I might not be hitting them all. Go ahead, Jeff.
Leaving Ruby going down the Yukon a few years ago, seeing a crescent moon rise, aurora overhead, and the lights of the village in the background. I mean, I almost had to stop. It felt it was spiritual. And a smooth moving dog team moving fast down the river. And the view was just absolutely spectacular. So one of my favorites.
There's doing an EAS test. You might hear a buzz in the background, so listeners aren't hearing us right now. It'll be another few seconds. I want to talk about Iditarod's coming with another 6 weeks or something like that. Everybody's signed up and qualified, or almost everybody's qualified, I guess. There have been two rule changes I want to talk about, Jeff. And people who follow the sport are aware of it, but there are two changes this year. And the first one is about two-way communication. You guys are going to be allowed to have any kind of two-way communication, cell phone, sat phone, pigeons, whatever. I want to talk about that in a minute, but I think the other rule change is probably going to have more of an impact, and that's that you're not allowed to take what's referred to as a caboose with, and this is one of your innovations. Everybody knows that a dog sled, I don't know how many years ago you came out with what we refer to as a caboose
trailer.
A trailer. It's not necessarily a solid piece of your sled, but it can be disconnected on most of them that I've seen anyway. And the idea is, your idea anyway, and I know people haul gear in them, but you rest dogs. You can run the Iditarod with 16, and you use that to rest dogs as you're moving along. You have been. And now that's not going to be allowed anymore.
What's the question?
The question is that going to impact your race? And I guess the other part of it is, why didn't you get involved in that discussion about that rule?
Well, first of all, nobody asked me, and I didn't even know it was considered until
after. I don't think anybody knew it was going to be considered.
Well, so why wouldn't I get involved? It would have been after the fact. And I was interviewed after the fact and just said I thought it was probably well-intended, but misguided. And I don't think it will be the right move for the future. I think they'll want to go back. There's all kinds of things wrong with it. But, you know, if I'm not willing to sign up to be on the rules committee or on the board, which I've been on both, I got to go with what they say. So I'm going to go with it. It will change how it already has changed my thinking on the race as I evolve and continue to grow and contemplate how I can best be most efficient for a dog race. But the part of that that's hardest for me is my accident last year outside Nulato. I'd have broken the rule by carrying my injured dogs into the village, and I had no other place to put them. They would not have fit in my sled, at least the way my sled was designed. Maybe they'll say, well, then your sled doesn't qualify anymore to be, but I think it's really wrong to, not really wrong, but wrong to make rules that are difficult to enforce. You're going to hear me talk about this in both the two-way communication and the trailer thing. I'm all for good sportsmanship and taking mushers, expecting them to be honest. But these rules are very difficult to enforce, that the two-way communication be only used in an emergency, or that your trailer not have a dog in it.
So you'll have a trailer, but you...
Oh, absolutely.
To haul gear.
Yeah.
Just to haul gear.
That's why, it was not designed just... It was weight distribution. I'm trying to get the musher's weight, the only thing the sled carries. And I wanted everything else to be off the sled. And it was so successful, it also went, this works so well, I could easily carry a dog. Mm-hmm. And it evolved to that. It was not to carry a dog. It was to get some room that reduced the load on the sled and made the sled more maneuverable. You know, my piece of video footage going down the gorge is now pretty well known.
If you haven't seen it, I'm talking to listeners, go check this out.
Yeah, go to YouTube. Mm-hmm. Type my name in and say Wild Ride. And I couldn't have done that year. People were scratching and crashing left and right. I didn't.
Breaking legs.
Yeah. No. I didn't, because my sled was maneuverable, because the weight was behind and there was a dog in there who was just fine.
So the rule is not that you can't have a trailer or a caboose. You just can't haul dogs in it.
And I believe it's... The way they've stated it, the way I've heard it, is that any required equipment has to be in the sled.
Right, right, right.
So my snowshoes and my axe have to be in the sled. A really dumb rule. I'm sorry, but they're way out of line trying to tell me which part of my sled to carry my stuff.
You think, and when you say that's not enforceable, you think that some guys on a long run out in the middle of nowhere, say going to Iditarod, will in fact pack sled dogs in there? Yeah. I don't disagree with that. I mean, some places they can't land an airplane and people can do whatever they want for 50 miles, 5 hours.
And do they want me to break? I'd like them to be able to tell me, what should have I done? As unique as a situation as it was last year.
Well, I'm going to get to that in a second here.
I couldn't have put three dogs in my sled without breaking the rule. Okay. And it would have been inhumane to the dogs to stack them on top of one another.
I wasn't even thinking about that. When I think about the incident on the river last year, I don't really think about the trailer and the caboose and how that helped you or might hinder you this year without being allowed to haul a dog. Let's talk about the two-way communication thing here. Again, 1200-733-1200, call and ask Jeff how he likes his coffee or whatever you want to ask. The other rule that they made, and there was discussion about this for months about this, and I believe it came out of the incident involving you and Allie and an intoxicated snow machine, and a dog died, another one got injured. Freaked both of you guys out, impacted your races. You can go through the whole litany, and I don't know that we need to do that. But all of a sudden, this year, and there's been discussion for years, you know, weren't allowed to use a GPS, and that fight went on, and now people are allowed to use a GPS, but no two-way communication. Now you're going to be able to have two-way communication. Some of the rationale behind that I heard was that to help people in a situation that you were in last year. And I want to ask this specifically, Jeff, where you were when you were, call it what you want, being assaulted by a snow machiner, would a cell phone or a sat phone helped you in that situation?
I believe it might have, yeah. Had I known a number to call, I'd have probably called for some help. It was a pretty serious situation, but I also had a button that I could push that would, I think, give me the same help that I need help. However,
you would have been out of the race.
I would have been out of the race. Yeah. Here's another thing. You know, I think, if they would have, and
were you in a place on the Yukon? I don't know exactly where it was. What is from Galena down to Nulato? It's like 35 miles or 50 miles, something like that. Were you in a place where you had cell reception?
They're talking sat phone. No, well, I don't believe so.
So let's talk about that. I've used sat phones out there. You're in a stressful situation, Jeff. You're going to get your sat phone out, and you're going to punch in the 9 numbers or whatever. There are times when I've had to make 20 calls to get through once on a sat phone.
I think their rule, I'm going to really try to play the devil's advocate, because I felt this. I feel the same way about the sat phone as I do the, a little bit, not entirely, but close to how I did about the GPS. I thought, that's not right. That's unfair. And now that I can use one, and I use one, I go, I don't want to use this thing. It's way too much trouble.
Yeah.
And it doesn't tell me anything that's really important. Mm-hmm. If there was, Lloyd Gilbertson broke his leg going over Blueberry Hill one time. I can paint you a scenario, not even on an annual basis, but over the life of the Iditarod, a couple of times, John Channelmeyer had issues. I don't know if that was the kind of thing, or he was helping someone who had an issue. But I can see a sat phone being a extremely rare avenue for, safety, and in that way I actually am okay with the thing, except that I think we should then, if you're going to have one, you got to declare it, and it needs to be in a sealed box that mm-hmm. has a seal, and if the seal's broken and indicates you've had your sat phone out, you need to explain why.
Because while you're going to be allowed
to use... It's an emergency.
While you're going to be allowed to use some kind of two-way communication, there is a rule that says you cannot have any outside help. And the concern is you can get on the phone and talk to your mom.
That's why I don't like, for the same reason, I mentioned, I think we can be expected to be honest and play by the rules. But I also think it's naive of the race organization to have rules that are difficult, if impossible, to enforce. If you can't track the calls, I can absolutely imagine. It has happened in my career. I have seen mushers on the phone I know who's are at a checkpoint getting coached. Mm-hmm. I don't believe it was illegal per se at a checkpoint, but if I had somebody feeding, if the technology was there that was feeding an outside rested person, was feeding me information, going, Jeff, what do you think? What do you see? Here's where they are. Here's where you are. Here's what I know. That's incredibly valuable. Mm-hmm. Information that would change the nature of the race. And that's what I think people don't want to see, that are against it. And the people that maybe want a sat phone want to know that, if a rookie musher has got a broken leg or went the wrong way, and the rules had said, well, you can't even carry this sat phone. Because I remember Nordman for years, he grabs my mittens or my coat pockets and he squeezes them when I finish the race. He's looking for a sat phone or GPS before it was legal. Friend or no friend, man, he meets you at the finish line giving mm-hmm. you the pat down, going, mm-hmm. people will think he's patting you on the back, but he's doing is patting down my pockets. And in both cases, I think until someone takes advantage of it, I'm not gonna bring one, and at least not, I can't imagine, but, you know, I didn't used to think a lot of things. You know, to carry an AM radio, it's a big deal to be able to listen to the news at McGrath.
Mm-hmm.
Fun. And there's information on there, you know, and get 1 hour or 2 hours worth of AM radio out of McGrath. And it was pretty fun. But, you know, I don't like either rule, but they're not game changers. And at least not as designed. And I think they weren't the best ones thought out, but over the years, rules change. Wouldn't be surprised to see those both change mm-hmm. again.
Okay, we've got about 5 minutes here. Jeff, I've got a couple of quick questions. What do you hear about snow in the mountains? I know that there's already conversation about going out of Fairbanks.
I think there will always be conversation about going out of Fairbanks, but I heard Rainy Pass got a foot and a half, and that was before the last storm. I don't track that because it changes so fast. Mm-hmm.
We'll see.
I don't know.
Yeah, they have a drop-dead date of February 10th, depending on conditions. Okay, do you listen to music while you're traveling? Do you have, or do you listen to anything while you're, you said you listened to AM radio for a while when you could, but.
Not anymore, Will. I almost not at all. I don't like the challenges of the technology and the batteries. I love the dogs. I love the peace and quiet. And it's very rare. I often have just one little 1-inch square iPod that may have some lively 10 lively songs on it. If I feel like I'm falling asleep and I need that, typically it's very short amount of time. I am still ferociously focused when I'm on the sled. I was thinking about this last night. I didn't turn my light on. I was home way after dark.
Well, you didn't need much of a light last night.
No, but in the trees, mm-hmm. and I thought, you know, okay, I know the trail, but I can't believe this bouncing and turning and banging. And I just felt this as at home as I could be. And I'm aware that, you know, I'm not graceful at all on the dance floor or in about any other capacity, but on the sled I feel so at home. That's where I do my best work.
How long are you going to do this, Jeff? Are you going to be one of those guys content with running 35th and 40th? And
I have no idea, Will. I have no idea, but I'm enjoying what I'm doing. As long as I'm enjoying it, I can't imagine not doing it. I feel so lucky. Last night, coming up the Annett River, I just went, and the sun was setting, and the orange-purple sunset, and I just thought, my God, how few people get to experience this ever, mm-hmm. much less on such a regular basis. I feel very, very lucky. And what motivates me now is to find people who are anxious to learn and learn. And I love mentoring new mushers.
It seems, with just another minute or so here, Jeff, it seems my contact with your group up there in Denali, you surround yourself with really bright young people that are just enthusiastic.
I have such a great crew this year, it makes all the difference. They're walk fast, play hard, eat good, are on time, and are anxious to learn, and take impeccable care of my dogs. They're dog lovers, and that's the common denominator that is just, there's no substitute for.
Jeff, good luck in the K300.
Hope to see you out there.
I'll be out there. And good luck in the Iditarod. I won't see you. Well, unless things go really wrong, I won't see you until we get to Nome.
All right, Will. Thanks for your time today.
Appreciate your making this happen, Jeff. You've been listening to Sioux Valley Voice. Jeff King, four-time Iditarod champion. I'll go through this whole litany here, Jeff. Nine-time K300 champion, won so many other races, and continues to be a competitive musher. Sioux Valley Voice comes your way on occasional Wednesdays at 10 o'clock. Hope you tune in for the next one, and have a great morning for KTNA. I'm Will Peterson. You're listening to KTNA Talkeetna. It's just about 11 o'clock, 7 degrees below zero.